So, you know this romance rom-com movie bracket?
Yes.
That we don't need to get into you choosing violence around that.
I have so much more ready to go.
Just set that aside. Do you know this about my daughter, that she became like very obsessed with Ouija boards this year?
No.
Do you know this?
Sure.
I don't actually know why. Somebody out there is going to be able to tell me why, but like, she's consuming some kind of media. I think it must be a graphic novel. Because like, mostly I know what TV she's watching.
Mm-hmm.
She's consuming some kind of media that's like, it has introduced her to the concept of the Ouija board, which I had one when I was little. And then I was like, she kept asking me for one. And I was like, I have one in my, like, there's one in my mom's house somewhere and I couldn't find it. And so I bought her a Ouija board, which is sitting in her room. And who knows what happens with that thing? Who knows what spirits she is calling upon from the
foretelling Bradley future.
Corporation. I don't think it's Milton Bradley, but it feels right that it's some sort of board game company. Anyway,
Pandora Ravenel.
So then, oh yeah, exactly. Nice job.
Always nice back job, to Jen. Romance. Always. That's where we are.
Okay. So, I'm also turning my microphone up because Eric told me that I was not loud enough, which is not a thing anybody has ever told me ever in my life since kindergarten report cards. So the rom-com movie bracket reminded me of the movie Only You.
I do not remember this movie.
Okay, so let me paint you a picture. Baby Marissa Tomei and baby Robert Downey Jr. fall in love in Rome in 1994.
That sounds nice. With a Ouija board.
So nice. Well, no, the way that it works is it's such a cute setup. Okay, so anytime anybody in the world... All right. I have so many things. I have so many thoughts.
You want to introduce us first or we're going to...
Yeah. Welcome, everyone, to Fated Mates. I'm Sarah McLean. I read romances, I write them, and I'm going to talk to you about them, this one, right now.
Okay. I'm Jennifer Prokop, a romance reader and editor. I am afraid of Ouija boards, so I've never actually played with one.
Oh, like you believe that you might just summon a spirit?
I think I saw some scary...
Your soulmate is?
Yeah, I saw some scary Ouija board.
This movie will
cleanse that for me.
Will cleanse the scary, and it will... Really, I was freaking delighted. All right. Anyway, so the point is, this is a movie from my youth. I was in high school when this movie came out and totally obsessed with it. Sure. I mean, like, because Robert Downey Jr. and Marissa Tomei.
It wouldn't be, right?
Adorable. So, all right. This is so cute. And what I wanted to say before then you said I should introduce us, Fated Mates and all, is... If you are a writer out there and you are struggling with the concept of what we mean when we say high concept.
Yeah.
This is what I'm about to explain to you is high concept. Okay. The movie begins. She is 11 years old. She is playing Ouija board with her brother. And she asks the Ouija board spirit to tell her the name of her destiny, like of her fated mate. So the Ouija board produces a name, Damon Bradley. And I will say anyone out there who only you imprinted on, you know, in those early days, literally it feels like we're just Damon Bradley girlies, like just floating through the world, Damon Bradleying. So anyway, cut to 14 years later, she is an English teacher at a high school, teaching about destiny. Like, she's obsessed with romantic poetry. She's like, believes in destiny. But she has she accepts a proposal from her boyfriend, who is like a very decent podiatrist.
But not named Damon Bradley, I assume.
Not named Damon Bradley. And literally, like, here we are, I don't know, 10 minutes into the movie, and she's like, really feeling like, I don't know. you know, yes, he's the right choice. It's clear that she's not like over the moon Damon Bradley in love with him. She's the phone on the wall rings. She picks up the phone and she says, there's the connection is bad. And the guy on the other end of the line says, I got the invitation to your wedding from my friend, your future husband. I'm sorry I can't be there because I'm going to be in Europe. I'm in Europe. And she says, oh, I can't hear you. What's your name? And he says, Damon Bradley. And she's like, and she,
I love
it. I don't want to ruin this because you guys, the idea is so strong. Like there.
Right. Boom. Right? That's it.
Like,
snakes on a plane.
Exactly. Like, you know, this woman is going to change her whole life now because some man named Damon Bradley called her 14 years after a Ouija board told her he was her destiny. So she goes to Italy and she finds Robert Downey Jr., who says he's Damon Bradley. And it goes on from there. And it's very adorable. And so last night I said to my daughter, like, there's a movie about a Ouija board. I think we should watch it. And we watched it and she was riveted to this, like,
amazing.
And here's what I will say. All these years later, what, 30 years later, God. I mean, first of all, they look like actual babies. But 30 years later, this movie actually does hold up. And so I think I talked on one of the episodes or on our Banter Plus episode for the Patreon about how, like, this bracket makes me sad in a lot of ways because it's like all the classic rom-coms like haven't been watched. So, you know, although I did see somebody on Twitter sort of saying, like, well, it goes in the reverse too. Like, it feels like there are a ton of people who haven't watched any of the new ones,
and so they just vote right for When Harry Met Sally or whatever, right?
But if you haven't seen Only You, it's really charming.
Is it streaming somewhere or do you have to buy it?
No, Eric was like, why do you keep picking these movies that aren't on streamers? And it is true because the other movie I've recently made, Victoria Watch, was Pitch Perfect, one of the Pitch Perfects, and that wasn't on, or maybe it wasn't, I can't remember. Anyway, point is,
you paid your $5
only
bucks or whatever.
You is top notch. And then Eric, so that was last night, and this morning Eric left. He's like away with, you know, men. And my daughter was like, what are we going to do? Cause it's pouring down rain. It's Saturday. And I was like, well, we should watch something. She was like, is there another movie that we can watch that would be like,
yeah, like that one
fun. And I was like, you know what movie I want to show you? And I showed her The Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants.
Perfect.
Which is
perfect.
You guys, if you are out there and you have a young girl, like a,
yeah,
I would say like 8 to 14.
Yeah, so cute.
In your life, and they have not seen Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants. It's so cute and actually really, really well done. Like better than I remembered. And of course, she like a little bit broke my heart because America Ferrara is a teenager in this movie. And she was like, why do I recognize that girl?
You're like, that's, you know, Barbie's friend.
That's the mom from Barbie. Anyway, all very exciting. So that's my update. Jen, you should watch Only You, and anybody with a tween should watch Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants.
I watched the first episode of a TV show on your recommendation, Sarah. I watched
Ripper Street.
Yeah.
And?
Yeah, it was great. I totally like was super into it. And basically, this is because I made fun of the man in Pride and Prejudice.
Yeah, but you see now that.
Yeah, I still
40 pounds on
I
him.
Don't feel that I'm wrong about the.
I know, Jen, but I explained unwashed, to you what your problem is.
Unwashed, I need a ride to my job at the fast food restaurant vibe that man gives off in everything. Every single people are like, look at him. And I'm like, he needs a ride to his job after school.
Jen,
anyway,
you're just not attracted to English
it's
men.
It's true. Well, I That's had a whole epiphany. A lot of things were happening. Anyway, so you were like, watch him. He's older and
Heavier.
And I was like, yes, that's what I like. And it was great. It was. I really liked it. And then it was funny because...
Is that the episode where he says, you and me alone?
No, he's busy. There's no ladies. There's no women in this show unless they're dead.
No, but it's like coming up. It's like in the second or third episode.
Okay.
It's...
With his wife? Is it with his wife?
He says it to his wife. Okay. Their marriage is falling apart. It's a whole thing. But... Yeah.
Anyway, it was great.
I'm so glad. And you know what? I mean, the first episode of the show is never a good episode.
Well, and it's funny because two nights later, I was like, oh, maybe I'll try and watch another one. And everybody, you need to understand that, like, my internal clock for watching TV is still set in the you watch one a week. So I just was like, you know what? I wasn't ready to watch another one 2 days later. Yeah. I was like, I got to wait till next week to maybe watch another one.
Yeah.
It's fine.
I get it.
So it was great, though. I totally enjoyed it.
Well, listen, we've just delivered three excellent suggestions to people who are out there just thinking about what to watch.
Well, come watch us in Brooklyn on March 23rd. We're going to be doing Faded Mates Live. I'm very excited about it. It will be with Kate Claiborne and Nikki Payne and Lauren Billings of Christina Lauren and a lot of people that you hang out with on the internet if you're in our Discord or Twitter or Instagram. And you can order... books in it. Now, this part is really important, everybody. If you are coming, you can pre-order books from The Ripped Bodice and they will like bring them, which is great. But most importantly, if you would like Kate Claiborne's new book, The Other Side of Disappearing, you can get it 3 days early at Faded Mates Live, but there's a cutoff. And that cutoff is March 14th, I believe. So you really need to make sure that you pre-order that one in particular, and then you can shop the night of or pre-order and also shop the night of.
Also, pay attention to your email, everyone who is coming, because you're going to get an email from us with information on meetups ahead of time and after the show, and also links for all of those pre-orders that Jen just talked about. And recommendations. Somebody did this like very fun recommendation thread. Was that in the Discord?
Oh, yeah. About bars near the William Vale and what they would be like if they were romance novels.
I mean,
it was perfect.
Terrific.
A plus.
No notes. And
one other thing, too, is like if you are interested in stickers and other merchandise from Kelly, she has a pre-order. She'll just like give you stuff there, including avatar buttons, which are really, honestly, very helpful. If people only know you from like how you look, your little circle,
tiny circle,
you can have that tiny circle on you and you'd be surprised at how great it is. You're like, oh, I know you. So that's also happening. But I am actually mostly getting just really excited now that it's March. I'm just like,
I cannot wait
for Faded
March Madness.
Exactly.
It's going to be so fun. It's a posh hotel, a posh room at a posh hotel. It's going to be fancy. And we're really excited. So, Faded Mates Live. It's always a good time.
Yes. All right. So, this week.
I can't believe that it's taken us this long.
Yeah. We're doing it.
Here we are. We're doing it.
Enemies to lovers.
Enemies to lovers.
And I have to tell you, I struggled a bit to find.
You've never read a book?
I've never read a book. Ever. And then I look at lists of enemies to lovers, of which there are many. And
I've never read a book.
You
can't do that.
No.
You can't do those lists.
No.
They're wrong.
No, they are often wrong, for sure.
Okay. We have a lot to talk about. I have a grid. I made a grid.
All right. Make it mathy. Talk to me about it.
No, it's not an XY axis. It's not as good as usual. But I think that's a piece of it, right? Like, I think there is an enemies to lovers. I think it's deeply misunderstood as a concept. I think a lot of people who are more who are newer to the genre perhaps like don't understand how much enemies we many of us are really talking about when we're talking about enemies to lovers. Like, I want it to hurt at the beginning.
So I think one of the things that is really often the case instead is people are really like describing rivals to lovers.
Oh, yes. That's the bottom left quadrant of my chart.
Why don't you talk about your chart then first and then we'll, because you have a structure.
I have four quadrants.
Okay.
I think we're going to talk about possibly the top two And then the bottom two, I think, are not relevant to this episode.
All right. Tell me what they are.
So the top two are enemies to lovers, straight up.
Okay.
Straight up enemies, straight up lovers. And then friends to enemies to lovers, which I think is like a segmented sort of different thing, because it often includes like, it includes like, it's more angsty in a lot of ways, I think.
Okay.
Because like, there was a time when you did
like this person.
Know/like/love.
Okay.
And also, caveat, lovers to enemies to lovers, also acceptable there.
Hmm. Okay.
But then I think on the bottom, in the bottom two, I have rivals to lovers, because I don't actually think most rivals to lovers count as enemies to lovers.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah.
Like, I would think, I think a lot of people talk about The Hating Game, like it's like a terrific enemies to lovers book. And The Hating Game is a terrific book. Jen and I have done, we've done a deep dive on it. I have no, I love The Hating Game, but it is not enemies to lovers. Point of order, it is rivals to lovers, and those who actually do enjoy each other's company the second they start to engage with each other personally.
Look at you, shot across the bow. Okay, I like it.
I think it's rivals to lovers, which is a different episode. Possibly next week. Who knows what we'll get
to. Who knows what we'll do. Okay.
But it's interesting because as I was going through like the blank to lovers list in my head, I started splitting them, which is why I have a grid.
Got it.
Because I was like, oh, no, that's rivals to lovers.
That's a different thing. Okay.
And then the bottom right corner is empty for me because it's friends to lovers and who cares?
Not your fave. Not your fave.
No. Friends to lovers is not for Sarah. And that is because Emily, because Emily to lovers. And that's because enemies to lovers is so much for Sarah.
Yeah, right.
But I'm like, why am I even here reading about these very nice people being very nice to each other?
Sure. Totally. I got you. Yeah. Enemies to lovers is for a different vibe.
I mean, I'm sorry out there. I know some of you love friends to lovers so much and I don't get it. So like, tell me. Hit me up on Instagram and tell me why.
Is it when we had Priscilla Olivares on? I think we did Friends to Lovers with the guest because both we were both like, okay. Sarah's like, I've never read a single Friends to Lovers book.
I've read one that I really liked and that was it.
So
Josh and Hazel's Guide to Not Dating Everyone.
There you go. Okay. here's where I choose violence a little bit, everybody, because I choose violence.
I mean,
no, I'm saying I am choosing violence again. I made fun
not
of
violence if it's true.
Oh, OK. Well, here comes my truth bomb. I was really like, OK, so remember, everybody, I've never read a book. And so I was like, OK, well, let me remind myself of these enemies to lovers books. I've certainly read. What is an enemy? What is a lover? Who knows? And then I was like, why are all these books old? And then I realized that enemies to lovers has fallen out of favor because people are afraid of conflict. They don't want it anymore, right? And you can't have enemies to lovers if you don't want to read about conflict.
No, I want it to hurt.
Yeah.
At the beginning.
Yeah. And so I think one of the reasons.
I just wanted to hurt at the end.
Yeah.
That's a different kind of hurt.
Yeah. I think one of the reasons that it is harder to find like more recent great examples is because it is people are, I don't know, reading softer books, right? For a variety of reasons.
Well, yes. I mean, friends to lovers is on the rise, or at least having a day.
Yeah. So, I mean, I have a couple that I think will be really good and I'm excited to talk about. But I just really was thinking, like, why are these kind of out of favor right now, right? Like, fake dating is about the only, is, you know, kind of, I don't know, like a big wave that has drowned all the enemies to lovers at the up the shore.
Okay, well, now here's where I like layer on the violence.
Okay.
I do have a what on the back of my card. It says, what makes enemies lovers work?
There you go.
Okay. So the first thing that's on the list is stakes.
Yes.
Right? So this is where you say conflict. And I think that stakes are essential to making enemies lovers work. The only way this idea functions is if these two people dislike each other intensely for a real reason.
Yes.
Right? So if, essentially, if love happens between these characters, something else has to fail.
Yeah.
right?
Yes.
So we see this like all the time. It's like it's very classic in like familial. There's often a family dynamic here. Like my father and your father are mortal enemies, and therefore we are enemies, right? Or there's a revenge piece, right? Like one perceives in some cases, one is perceived to have wronged the other. In some cases, they actually did wrong the other. I say take the finger and go straight to the they actually did. But like a heart of blood and ashes, right, is a very strong enemies to lovers book, because he believes that she murdered his parents.
Yes.
It is a perceived wrong, but it doesn't. But like, and the, I mean, like, this is also an example of a book where miscommunication or like a misunderstanding is deployed perfectly.
Yes.
But the stakes here are so high because, one, he believes that he is exacting revenge, mm-hmm, by kidnapping her and like taking her away, you know, and but also he, if they love, if they fall in love, he, what breaks is his loyalty, perceived loyalty to his family. Right. Right?
Like it costs him something.
He cannot love her and be the son his parents deserved. In his mind.
Yeah. You know what I think about a lot with that book? It's like this. That's a book
that's perfect.
That it's perfect, right? This book is perfect. But there's this thing where he keeps threatening to like cut out her tongue.
I think about it once a week, at least, that tongue thing. Explain. Everybody, also, you should run and read this book and then go and listen to the deep dive that we did.
Yeah.
But now, Jen, go.
Well, he just keeps threatening to cut out her tongue because he's like, you're lying, right? Like, he's like, I'm not interested. Like, stop talking to me. Like, just.
She did not kill his parents. In fact, she loved his mother. Like, his mother was like her, was,
yes,
somebody who was incredibly important to her. But every time he brings up, or every time she brings up his parents, he says, if you say any more, I'm going to cut out your tongue. So she's never allowed.
She's never allowed to speak. Oh, God, it's so good. He doesn't want to hear her. Like,
it's pure patriarchy, right?
And
it's right, so good.
And it's like the other thing I just have so much respect for is it's like, and because it's in a world where that kind of violence is acceptable, right? You kind of like take a, like it takes a minute for your brain to realize like it's both like a real threat and metaphor, right? Like, mm-hmm. You will not speak their names. I will not hear what you have to say about them. And then because of that, he's like trapped in his own hell because he can't listen. Right.
Yes.
It's so good. And that's the part I think like, oh, God, that book is perfect.
It's, I mean,
in every way. Perfect.
Freaking perfect.
Literally in
like,
every way.
It's, I mean, whatever. But the point is like it's stakes. Right. And what I mean by that is like we, the reader, have to understand what the stakes are. So I mean, yes, I totally agree with you. I made this list. Most of these books are old. Like, and by old, I mean like 30 years old, like 30 or 40 years old.
Right. They're old.
Right. Like the first book that always comes to mind when I think about enemies to lovers is A Kingdom of Dreams.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Where like, again, another book we read, we did a deep dive on. It holds up. It's by Judith McNaught. These two are warring clans, like warring families in medieval England. And there is a sense of just like at any moment, one family could kill the other.
Yes.
And she fights him every step of the way because she's been trained by her family to believe the familial loyalty is the most important characteristic that a person can have, even when your family is a bad actor.
Yeah.
Right. Horrible things happen in this book and they fall for each other anyway. And at the end, literally, the stakes are he is going to die if she doesn't. admit that, like, if she doesn't turn her back on this, like, feud. And
it's so
these
good.
Are, I mean, now granted, right, this is a medieval, so the stakes are able to be, and Heart of Blood and Ashes is a fantasy, so it's like the stakes are able to be that high.
Right.
Right, like, Cressley's vivisection.
Yes.
Mr. Vivisection.
Right.
Right?
Dreams of a Dark Warrior.
Thank you. Like, he literally vivisects her.
Yeah.
Which, like, it's, but she's an immortal, so, like, she's not gonna die. Right?
Yeah.
But, like, that's pretty awful. And they have to, like, the stakes are so high. Like, how are they ever going to get together is, I mean, that's the fundamental question of an enemies to lovers. And that's why I think part of the challenge, Jen, and this could be me choosing violence, I don't know. There might be a lot of moments where we choose violence. This wasn't the violence I thought I was going to choose today, though. But with the rise of contemporary and the fall of everything else,
yeah,
we are not seeing it because contemporary can't play these games the way historical, fantasy, paranormal, etc. can.
This week's episode of Fated Mates is brought to you by Parker S. Huntington and L.J. Shen, authors of My Dark Desire.
Jen, there are not enough good Cinderella retellings out there these days.
Agreed.
But Parker Huntington and L.J. Shen are trying to turn that tide. Here we go. A modern day retelling of Cinderella. Our main character, Pharaoh Ballantyne, has no choice but to sneak into Potomac, Maryland's most heavily guarded manor, which happens to be inhabited by a very handsome billionaire. She's got, for romance reasons, a pendant inside that house that is very important to her, and she has got to get it back. So it's very simple. She's going to sneak in, steal the pendant, and sneak out, and no one is going to find her.
Uh-oh. Except what happens?
Jen, would you believe this handsome, unattainable bachelor billionaire is just in there
and waiting to catch her?
Catches her. And then, instead of punishing her or calling the cops or just sending her on her way, he decides to keep her. And he's going to make her be his housekeeper. So she has no choice. She's stuck. This is like forced proximity in a real sense. And she is going to stay. And they might initially hate each other, but ultimately these two are going to fall hard in love and they have met their match.
If you would like to read this new adult romance, it's a Cinderella retelling. We've got double grumps, billionaires, revenge, a tortured hero, and of course, all of the forbidden forced proximity you could ever want. It is available in print and ebook and with your monthly subscription to Kindle Unlimited. And if your podcast app supports it, you can click on the chapter title to buy the book right now. Also, stick around, because at the end of this episode of Fated Mates, you can hear an audio excerpt of My Dark Desire. Thank you to Parker S. Huntington and L.J. Shen for sponsoring this week's episode. So here's where I feel like this is where, like, mafia romance can come in.
Yes.
And now,
yes,
what's interesting to me is I'm sure people are like, this is where dark romance comes in too. But for me, it doesn't, because mafia is sort of the place where I think you can get, like, here's why. You need parity.
Enemies. They have to be enemies.
Yes. They can't, like, be, like, you can't have a huge, massive power imbalance in enemies to lovers. Otherwise, it's like the equivalent of, like, you know, somebody's got their hand outstretched on the other person's head who's just swinging and can't touch them, like a little kid, right? And so, and, you know, dark romance very rarely has equals like that, right? So I was gonna-
Well, also, it feels like it has to be proactive enemying.
Yes.
Right? Like,
yeah, right.
I think the challenge, and this is, people are going to be upset. Dark romance fans are going to be upset, I think, with what I'm about to say. And I don't mean it to be upsetting, but often in dark romance, or at least in the dark romance that I have read, which is granted not as much as many of you, the heroines are simply not proactive. They are, like, they are kidnapped or dragged through the muck or like thrown into a situation where like they are captive or they are like being controlled or they are imprisoned or they are whatever.
Yeah.
But it's a passive voice, right? They are blank.
Right.
Right. Like right. Instead of, you know, they get themselves imprisoned because they've been, you know, they broke into the hero's house to kill him.
Yeah, one of my favorite scenes in the Avengers is like it's like Black Widow, and she's like, it looks like she's getting the crap beat out of her, right? And like someone comes in to save her, and she was like, I was almost done with my interrogation, and he'd almost told me everything, and she just was like playing the guy the whole entire time. And
yeah,
you know, I again, like, I'm sure, and you know, please tell us, I'm sure you can think of a few dark romances where that is not true, but yeah, you need to start off with people being equals, or there being parity, and that's just not really what dark romance traffics in.
Well, there also needs to be equal skin in the game.
Yeah.
Right?
Right. Like,
in order for it to be true enemies to lovers, you have to feel like either one of them could lose.
Yes.
And it would be real bad.
Yeah. So in Mafia Target, which is by our friend Mila Finelli, Joanna Shoups, one of Joanna Shoups' pen, I guess her only pen name. I should be like, one of, what do I know? Anyway, this is a gay romance between an assassin, Alessio, and Julio, who is like the son of Fausto, who's like the, you know, the her Derek Craven, her Sebastian St. Vincent, right? Like, just like this powerhouse character from the first books in this Kings of Italy series. Anyway, Julio has kind of appears in the first couple books. He is young, very young. I mean, like 18 or 19 and closeted. And as like sort of a condition of the ending of book two, he is going to like escape the life, like just like leave it because, you know, for various reasons, one of which is like, would they ever accept a gay mafioso and like the, you know, the mafia, and like there's all these really rigid rules around everything, around, you know, having families and wives and all that stuff. And so there's just no way for him to be part of this world. So he leaves. And this is a really big deal, like, right? Like, it's really him turning away from like a life he kind of understands and loves in order to like, you know, kind of be out there. And so he is at the beginning of the book, like, I don't know, like living in some little, you know, province in Scotland or something. You know what I mean? Like he is and he is kind of struggling because like this entire world that he thought he knew, right? He has renounced. He's renounced his birthright in order to essentially be free. And Alessio has been hired to kill him. And because
assassin,
he's an assassin, terrific. Right? And so what we get is like this real like clash of the titans kind of feeling, right? Like you have like this mafia prince on one side and this, you know, completely cold-blooded assassin on the other. And what they end up, so he, you know, he finds him in Scotland and then they end up falling in love. And then it's kind of a, well, how can we live in, you know, we can't leave this world. There's no leaving this world, right? You tried and it's not going to work. And so how can we then, it's like conquer it, right? So the enemy's part really is like that he's going to kill him. And it's not like what I guess I like about it is it's not necessarily personal, which in some ways I think makes it even more like pressing, right? Like this isn't something I can just like lay down my dislike for you. I have a job to do. And if I don't do it, then what's going to happen to me? Right?
Yeah.
And it's great.
You know, Mila has a really good handle on how to thread that enemies to lovers needle. You know, certainly in some of the books, she leans harder into like kidnapped daughter of my rival, right?
Right.
That's the first one.
Right.
Mafia virgin. Is that right?
No, mafia mistress.
Mafia mistress.
That's right.
Right. But in Mafia Madman, which is I don't know, either right before or right after the one you were just talking about. There, that also, that has some of that dark romance, like he kidnaps her. He's right. like the villain of the play. Like he's been the villain for multiple books. Right. But she pairs him with a heroine who is not taking any of his shit.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that she has been like thrown into his yacht cage.
Right.
So, I think you're right. I think it does ride, and he kidnaps her because she is the sister-in-law of his rival whom he wants to punish.
Yeah.
So there is a sort of deep enemy piece here. The stakes here, though, are as soon as they start to fall for each other, like the one, what happens to the rivalry, and two,
yeah.
You know, like how is she go again, it's that familial loyalty,
yes,
right?
Right.
I keep, now that, you know, when Sophie Jordan said to me, like, all mafia books are just medievals.
Yeah. You were like, it rewired my brain. Absolutely.
Like, now I can't unsee it anymore. And so, like, the family rivalry in mafia books, it's warring clans, right? So it just, it literally was the book that I put down next after A Kingdom of Dreams. And I think it's just because, like, my brain went medievals, mafia.
Yep.
And then
yeah.
I want to talk about how it can be done without, like high stakes drama, like somebody might die.
Okay.
And I do think that there is something to be said for historicals for being able to deliver that, too.
Mm-hmm.
Because in historicals, there is such a powerful... reputation holds such powerful weight in historicals.
Yeah.
And I think, like, that's not to say reputation can't hold weight in other, in contemporaries too, but like reputation is the realm of the historical, right? And so I want to talk about Courtney Milan's Unlocked, which is a novella. And I a lot of people love Courtney in general, and I just think, like, this book, this novella proves that, like, this is, I think, the place where Courtney shines the best, this in this sort of small bite. If you've never read Courtney, do this one. So Unlocked is essentially like a bully historical. These two characters, long ago, when the heroine came out in society, the hero and a group of his friends, like, basically destroyed her reputation for kicks and, like, made her feel really bad about herself, like, made her the laughing stock of like society. And I think the other thing that historical is able to do with this, with reputation, that, you know, contemporary maybe is less able to do, is the society that is built in historicals is so tiny,
yeah,
that it feels like, you know, one misstep and that's it. You're ruined forever. You're unmarriageable. You're a woman, so you won't ever be able to, like, own property or, like, have, you can't, you, your literal life is ruined. And so he goes away and she gets older and he comes back and she's, like, on the shelf. She's the spinster on the shelf. And he, like, comes back kind of ready to make amends.
Mm.
And she won't have it.
I love that. Don't forgive them.
No, I mean, it's terrible. And what he did was terrible. And Courtney really threads an interesting needle here because she does not forgive him, mm-hmm, for what he's done, but she really considers the weight of societal expectation in this tiny little novella in a way that I think a lot of historicals, you know, dance around, but Courtney doesn't, she's not afraid of, like, really digging deep and looking at that. And so we don't talk a ton about Courtney on the podcast, but you should start there with Unlocked.
Yeah. I have a recommendation that I think is sort of similar, like you're talking about reputation, but I'm going to, like, preface this by saying, like, you cannot just, like, pick up this book and read it. Like, it is really reliant on having read the Kate Daniels series. So the book is Iron and Magic by Ilona Andrews. And in the Kate Daniels series, the big bad guy is named Roland. Which is not a fear that strikes, you know, fear into the heart of me, but whatever, it will, mm-hmm, if you read these books. But then, like, Many books in, so Roland's like warlord, which, you know, I love this, right? His like kind of first in command.
I love a
warlord. Is this guy named Hugh Dambray. And he is awful the entire, like, he will do anything to try and fuck with Kate. He tries to break up Kate and Curran. He is just like constantly terrible. He's always conniving and, you know, just terrible. And so it's late in the series, 7 or 8 books into the series, he essentially gets fired by Roland and just like disappears. And in this book, so this is like a spinoff, he ends up his men are called the Iron Dogs, like his warriors. And people essentially are killing them off and he can't quite figure out why. And so he ends up like teaming up with this woman named Alara, who is trying to keep her people safe. And essentially they strike this like real devil's bargain and they cannot stand each other. But he can help her essentially like fortify her literal castle with his men. And in return, she can like sort of like put them all up and give them a safe place for them to sort of like recover. Right. And this is like one of those things where you're like, there is no way that you are going to make me like Hugh Dambray. Right. And like I said, I think this would be a really difficult book to read cold. It is. They do not trust each other at all. And there's this one really great part where, like, they actually, I think, have to get married. You know, I mean, and they're like both like, okay, fine, I guess we have to do this to save our people. Where, you know, like the first wave of attackers comes at them and, you know, like they're fighting or something. And he realizes that she hasn't told him about like some razor wire that she has possession of. And he's like, why didn't you tell me about that? And she's like, the fuck are you talking about? And he's like, when I told you I needed to know everything we had, like, I mean, it's just like this like really dramatic series about like a story about like these two people who hate each other but like are forced. It's really like the only way to work together. And you know, like I said, you can't read it cold, but it really is one I think of often when I think of true people who are truly like, I cannot fucking stand you. Let's go.
Yeah. So I think I have a couple of contemporaries on my list.
I do too. I have two.
And I'm trying to sort of think. I've been thinking a lot about like how they are similar, like what it is about a contemporary that really works for me when it's enemies to lovers. So I think there are two versions of this that work. I think the first is we are thrown together by friends and or family. Mm-hmm. And like we just don't like each other. Right?
Okay.
And I think that is it's a very, very good setup in the hands of the right author. Like, I think that it can quickly not have any teeth because of aforementioned conversation about stakes. I'm just going to name check two books that do that because we've done deep dives on both of them. The first is Her Best Worst Mistake by Sarah Mayberry, which we have both said multiple times, we believe is like
a perfect
top tier A+ enemies to lovers.
Yes.
Book. It is her best friend was supposed to marry him. And instead, she takes off and then the hero blames the heroine for his bride, like essentially leaving, his fiance leaving. And they fucking hate each other. And she's basically like, I have hated you. I didn't think she should marry you.
Right.
You're terrible. And he's like, you're terrible. I hate you more.
Yes.
And then
let's bang.
They like, and so part of the stakes there is like their own false view of themselves and each other. The other one is Asking for Trouble by Tessa Bailey, which is still, I think, my favorite Tessa Bailey book, where they are each of their best friends. So the hero's best friend and the heroine's best friend get married in an earlier book in the series. and these two hate each other. But they have to, they're sort of forced into having to deal with each other because they're planning, you know, there's a wedding happening. So they are, they have to be together for the bachelorette party and the engagement party and the wedding. And they can't stand each other. And still. This week's episode of Faded Mates is sponsored by Blue Box Press, publishers of Skye Warren's Blue Moon, the next in her Cirque de Miroir series.
So this one is one of the novellas in the Smoke and Mirror series, and we have charismatic, devious, and secretive Emerson Durand. He is the ringmaster at this circus, and he also likes to be the ringmaster in the bedroom.
Oh boy, you love a circus romance.
I do love a circus romance. And in every city where they travel, he finds a new woman to command for the night until he finds this one woman who is not going to bow to his demands. Her name is Luna Ryder, and she is an aerialist, which I love. I think that's so cool to have an aerial acrobat as a heroine. She is, you know, determined to provide for herself and her sister, but she really cannot resist Emerson. And there is the and all the secrets that seem to come with his appearance and arrival on the scene. So this is a quick moving novella in the Smoke and Mirror series, and you're definitely going to want to read it.
If you also love a circus romance, you can find Blue Moon in print and ebook right now. And if your podcast app supports it, you can click on the chapter title to buy the book right now. Thanks to Blue Box Press and to Skye Warren for sponsoring this week's episode.
My other ones are all workplaces because I feel like that's the other place that you can get like sort of really strong.
Oh, interesting.
Like I have feelings.
None of them are workplaces.
Interesting. Okay. So
you go. Why don't you go?
Well, I want to name check. The worst guy.
They are not rivals.
No, they, you know what it is? I was thinking. So
they just hate working with each other.
You know what it is? It was like, usually when I think about it, and these three books have this in common. They work together, but they disagree intensely about the, like, how to do the work. Does that make sense? So they aren't in direct competition, but they are like, in like essentially like they have a different worldview, and because they work together, this is like illuminated for them, right? So one is The Worst Guy by Kate Canterbury, which I think is like a real fan favorite. Lots of people love this book, and they are both essentially reconstructive plastic surgeons, like do that kind of work. And what happens is she is like basically thinks he's like a hatchet man. Like he doesn't care as much about like what things are going to look like after the surgery is done. Whereas he thinks that she is like doesn't understand that sometimes it's like life or death and who cares if there's like a scar, right? And so he thinks she's just sort of this like prima donna. And she just thinks that he is, you know, like utterly ridiculous in the way that he like operates. And basically these two, I mean, and this part like was a little hard for me to believe, but they have some sort of scuffle at work that is like so elevated that they get ordered into like conflict resolution. And then they have to like sort of figure out like, okay, maybe I can see their point of view in a different way, right? A very similar setup to that is, but one that I actually thought the like, it has a really hot opening. Like I literally read it and I was like, I've never read anything like this before. It's called Fighting for Control by J.J. Arias. And in this book, it's Lola and Carmen, and they both work for, Lola is an agent and Carmen is a lawyer, and they both work for like a PR, like an, I don't know, like a Dominion is the name of the agency. It's like I don't think she's a sports agent, but like whatever. Details don't really matter because wait till I tell you about the beginning of this book. I was agog. Like I was like, oh, they mean it. J.J. Arias is not playing. So Lola, the book opens with Lola trying to get to work. And she has like, she's looking down at a cup of coffee with the word like Natalia on it. And it's her, you find out later it's her boss. And she is, there's like, she's on a Miami street and there's a bus and then the parking garage she's trying to get to where her office is. And so there's the bus and her car. And then she sees up ahead Carmen's SUV. And she's just like, God damn it. Carmen's going to beat me into the garage and be the first one in the office. And like, you're not really quite sure why this is so important, but the light turns green and Lola like floors it and then like tries to cut across all these lanes of traffic, cuts off Carmen, who is essentially trying to also make it into the garage. And then the two of them literally get into an accident. Because Lola is driving so recklessly and something about this like triggers Carmen to do the same thing. They almost hit the guy in the garage who's like just trying to put the garbage away. They have this, and then like they like, you know, like Lola stomps out of her car and Carmen stomps out of her car, and you're like, what is going on? It like it is sky high. And you know, Carmen's like, you know this was your fault. And Lola's like, you're the one eating my ass because like, you know, Carmen hit her. And then like they both kind of freeze and you realize these two have been in bed together.
Oh,
and you don't know why and you don't know how, but you know that they've done it and they fucking hate each other still. And instantaneously, it's like, what's going to happen? And they like the worst guy get offered that they have, like essentially they get told you have to go to, you know, conflict management. And both of them are like, that's ridiculous. Nobody can force me to do it. But then the people who can force them to do it, force them to do it. And the thing about Lola in particular is like, you are just like, what? Like Carmen is always trying to like stay cool and stay calm. And Lola is just a firecracker. And you're like, why is she so angry all the time? And it really takes like a long time for you to figure out like why she's so aggressively like in your face. But I literally was like, a literal bang. It starts with this car crash, right?
Perfect.
Yeah, it was great.
I'm going to get that right now.
I have one more. Can I talk about it? Okay.
Yeah.
This one
I have a lot more.
Oh, okay.
I have a feeling you're going to have others that you want to talk about when I bring up two more things.
Oh, I'm sure. But these are like the workplace ones. This one, listen, we mentioned this because it was an ad last week by Kayla Wolfberg for this book called Late Night Love. And I was like, oh, it's enemies to lovers. I should look at it. Like, right? Like, it's new. It literally just came out. And if you'll remember, everybody, she wants to be on. Okay, so like we're reading the ad. She wants to be the Weekend Update writer for a TV show that's called like Late Night in New York. And so what happens is I'm reading the book and this is all in the first chapter or two. There's two guys on the like Weekend Update desk, Alex and Chris. And she is like, everybody hates Alex. His dad is some bigwig. We all know that he has just has this job because of his relationship to the, you know what I mean? He's a Nepo baby. And everyone hates him. He is a jerk and he is an asshole and fine, right? But where the person she really hates, though, is Chris. Because she's like, but everybody loves Chris. Ha ha. Not like that TV show. But she's like, but why? Because he is constantly enabling Alex. And it's really like heartfelt. Like you're like, oh, yeah, that is a good point. Like it's everyone hates the guy everyone hates. But like she hates the guy who enables the guy everyone hates. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I don't want to spoil it because the joke that she like slips into the cue cards is really good. And Alex, remember, this is live TV. When it says and like loses his mind and is shouting like, who fucking did this on live TV? And then like does some other stuff. And essentially the producer is literally like, you're fired to Alex right now. But then here are the stakes. She's like, I'm making you and Chris not just head writers of the woman's name is Emily. You and Chris are not just head writers of the Weekend Update, but of the show, because our ratings are in the tank. And that laugh she got was the biggest laugh, not that just we got tonight, but we got all season. And if we do not like turn this ship around, they're going to cancel the show. And I was like, smart. There you go.
They have to work together, even though they hate each other.
Yes. And I was like, and there you go. Like it stakes, right?
Perfect.
Boom. It was great. It's great.
All right. So I have two things. I want to talk about shame. And I think this is one of those things. It is really tricky. This is a tricky line for writers, because I think when you and I came to romance a million years ago, shame, particularly the heroine feeling shame, was like a very big piece of this plot line. Like, I think old school romance does this very well in terms of like making, really breaking the heroine on page, or at least like attempting to break the heroine on page until the hero sees
the truth,
like just how bad it is. So there's a book that's in my head that I do not remember the name of, and I do not remember what it is. But so I'm going to tell you a story and you're going to tell me if you remember this. But I'm going to talk, but let me give you some examples of how this works. So the trick here, and the reason why I say it's tricky, is because there is a balance between making the heroine so ashamed, deploying shame as something for the heroine to feel, to make her hate the hero enough that like it is true enemies, right? And so that is the balance that you're trying to strike. But very often in this, it falls into like, oh my God, this heroine's like a doormat.
Yeah.
And like, it's not fun to watch this.
No.
Right? So what I'm thinking about, I think there are two people. There's one person who does this like almost perfectly every time she does it, and that's Susan Elizabeth Phillips.
Every time. I knew you were going there, right?
You can't talk about enemies to lovers without talking about Ain't She Sweet, where Sugar Beth, the setup is that Sugar Beth has done a very terrible thing. When she was a teenager, she basically told the staff of her small town high school that the English teacher, the brand new young male English teacher, had sexually harassed her. It was not true. It was immediately fired. He left town, and then he comes back however many years later, triumphant. He's written like a memoir/biography of this small town, like a Tracy Kidder style book of this small town, returns, buys the like home where Sugar Beth's family had been sort of on high there, and then like basically hires Sugar Beth to be his servant.
Yeah.
And like it is hot, the shame that she feels when she's like made to like serve the once girls, now women who went to high school with her. It is almost impossible to imagine how this romance is going to work out, but it's Susan Elizabeth Phillips, so it works perfectly. And then I think also Susan does this well in something like Kiss an Angel, right? Like,
oh my God, everybody, listen, they are apparently redoing the whole gorilla enclosure at the Brookfield Zoo. Where I was like, I guess I have to read Kiss an Angel again. Sorry, everyone.
I mean, Kiss an Angel is terrific. You should go listen to Jen's episode of Learning the Tropes about Kiss an Angel. It's so fun, but it's also another one where like shame is really interestingly deployed. And then there's like a very, listen, check your content warnings. I'm not even sure that I don't even love recommending this book anymore, but it is a book where like shame is very, I think, well deployed against a backdrop that is like deeply problematic in a number of ways. But I'm thinking about like Megan McKinney's Till Dawn Tames the Night. Mm-hmm. Like these are sort of like very big old school books that do this. Here's my question for you, Jen.
Yeah.
There is a romance novel. I'm pretty sure it's historical. This is a question for everyone.
Yes.
The heroine, it's this kind of thing. Like she's basically forced to like be his servant. She's like scrubbing floors, like basically, and he keeps saying to her, like, if you admit that I've broken you,
it all stops.
And she refuses.
I definitely read that book, but what book is it?
I mean, first of all, I think I've read this book probably in like many different forms.
Yes.
Like, I think this is a very classic old school romance setup because it's a way for us to like really visualize patriarchy, right? Like, he is unwilling to, he knows what he is doing to her and he lets it happen because she won't admit she doesn't like it.
It's a heart of blood and ashes. It's the same thing, right?
Exactly.
Just tell me I've won and I'll stop. Right.
Yeah. And so when we say like these books are inherently feminist, like not to get on my high horse, but here I am, like this is what I'm talking about. Like this was transcendent in the 80s,
yeah.
Like the 70s, 80s and early 90s, like this concept, mm-hmm. right? We could see visually what these heroes were doing. And it was a mirror of what the world does to women and other marginalized groups. Right. So I can't think of it. And I can, but I can like see him ultimately break, like,
yeah,
fundamentally, right? What ends up happening in these books is it's the hero who breaks.
Yeah.
The heroines are strong as steel. But when the hero breaks, he breaks because he sees what he's done or like what he's attempted to do.
Mm. Yeah. No, I definitely have read that book.
Right?
Yeah. Of course.
So, like, I think that where I'm at here is like when we talk about enemies to lovers, like that's what I want. I want it to feel like somebody's going to break.
Well, and I think like the other thing about books like this is like when we say check your content warnings, like they're boundary crossing, right? Like
very
like not just in like the content warning way, but like literally like this is. You really have to see people like fly way past the point where they should have stopped, right? I mean, you know, you have to like literally be willing to like be like jamming on the gas when you should be like just letting the person go in front of you into the parking garage, right?
Yeah.
And I think that that's why like enemies to lovers, when it works, is like you really feel like these people are on the edge.
Yes.
Right? Like there's something about the way this works that they're just kind of like, we're, you know, here's where I am, right at the edge. Now what? Right?
Yeah. So my last books, the last books that I want to recommend are contemporary marriage of convenience stories, because I think that is an example of a trope that has higher stakes in contemporary in many ways than it does in historical.
Yeah.
Like I think in historical it's like, I need a title. Okay.
Sure.
I have a daughter. Right?
Like, right.
Or like whatever it is. And we sort of, we use it so regularly that it can be done on, you know, mm-hmm. on a full scale, a full spectrum of emotion.
Yeah.
But in contemporary, if you're going to set up a marriage of convenience, it has to have, it has to be real, right? Like why on earth would that happen without there being some sort of really significant stake?
Yeah.
So I want to talk about Angelina M. Lopez's Lush Money.
Okay.
Which I think is a very good example of how this can work. The heroine of that book is a billionaire mm-hmm. who a Latinx billionaire who has had to like prove herself at every point in her life in order to succeed. She is a self-made billionaire. And she has decided that she wants to have a child who she can pass on like all of her, you know, money and power and strength to. Mm-hmm. But she would like for that child to never be questioned on any level. And so she strikes a deal with an aging king of a small European nation.
Sure. Amazing.
And she's basically like, I will bail out your country if with my billions, like my billions that easily cover your gross domestic product, right?
Mm-hmm.
If your son basically impregnates me. Like I need an heir.
Right.
We both need an heir. And he thinks he's going for like a like first time, like a first date. And it's actually like a wedding.
Yeah.
And then like he has to sign the papers. And then like there is a sex scene in this at the very beginning of this book that feels old school in so many different ways. And it just feels like this is a good example of like, and then they have 1 year. She's like, I will divorce you in 1 year, assuming that this has taken and we are having, like, I have a child.
Mm-hmm.
Then we never have to speak again and I will bail out your country and you will be a national hero.
Sure.
But you don't get this baby and like we never This is the deal. And he talk about shame.
Yeah,
right. It flips the script on everything because he's like, what the fuck? Like, this is not how it's supposed to go. But also his hands are tied because he wants to save his country.
Yeah. Who wouldn't?
And then exactly. Right. And then the other one is Naima Simone's Vows in Name Only. And I think also there's something to the fact that both of these books are basically categories. They really have, they both have, they neither of them are Harlequin Presents, but they don't both have very like strong presents feels.
Yeah.
And Vows in Name Only, the heroine is her, like both the heroine and the hero have basically been blackmailed by her father to marry.
Yeah.
And they don't have, neither of them have any choice. He's holding like her trust fund, her like funds hostage for, you know, it's Naima. So, of course, she's like running a like nonprofit for something and he won't let her have the money for it. And but it's essential for like a blossoming community. And the hero is like trying to protect his mother from a, you know, really terrible secret that if it gets out will change everything. And so, and the her father wants, the heroine's father wants access to the hero's like high level community. And it, they are forced to marry. They both know why they are in it, but they don't know why the other one is in it. So, like, there's also, like, a secret here. Because if they, again, if they tell each other the truth, the air is out of the balloon. Another place where, like, in the hands of great authors, misunderstandings and secrets work really well.
Yeah, I mean, because that's the thing. It's like, you're not going to trust your enemy or someone you don't, right, like, with your biggest secret. So, I guess I would say the last enemies to lovers, like, bucket for me is, and you mentioned this earlier, like essentially like family feuding, right? Like we're on two sides of this family.
Right. Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah. And the one I was going to talk about is but again, I think like in order for the stakes to be really high, like you have to kind of believe that there's some real beef between these two. And so in Joanna Wilde's Reapers Motor Club series, book number 3 is called Devil's Game. And what happens is the daughter from the like Reapers MC, like her dad is like the president. So she's like the princess of the MC in some ways, falls in love with someone from like another club who is, it's like their biggest enemies. Right. And so, you know, not only are they like sort of falling for each other, like she's like desperate to get out from like her, you know, like her dad is like super overprotective. Her mom died of cancer when she was younger. So she's like really kind of been raised alone by, she loves her dad, but she's just like, I want out of this. Right. But her dad is like this wild man. I think in, I'm like reading the blurb to remind myself, right, the last time she had a boyfriend, her dad shot him. Right. And so like these men want to keep her dad happy. And she is looking for someone who will kind of like look past all that, like will, you know, not treat her like a stepping stone to her dad or whatever. And so, you know, to find someone who Liam is, but like he's in like the enemy club. So it's like, you know, she's really like crossing her dad and his will, but he's also the only one who like doesn't give a shit about her dad, right? And it's ultimately it's a great book in the series because the rest of the series really focuses on the one, like the Reapers. And then this is one that's kind of like outside of that world because she wants outside of that world so badly. And again, it's like this question of like who I want so badly to like get out of the world where I'm defined by my family. And yet I am who I am because of my family, right? Like, I think it's like a really compelling, again, the stakes are really compelling.
It's good. When it's done right, it's the best.
Delicious.
It's the best.
I have to tell you, like back to like late night love, I could not believe how good the joke is, like how pissed this guy gets.
All right, well, I'm going to read it.
Yeah,
right,
you're going to have to read it.
I'm very excited. I have two on my list now because of this. Yeah, I'm looking at my list. Is there anything else? We didn't really talk about any friends to enemies to lovers.
No.
But, you know.
Yeah.
And that's a whole nother episode, maybe. Oh, and I have, like, I have Kate Claiborne's Luck of the Draw on here.
Right.
Again, sort of a, like, it's not quite enemies to lovers, but it is.
Right.
It, the stakes are incredibly high, and he really hates her.
Yeah. Right. So, right.
I mean, I think there's that, too. It's that question of, like, is there, can it be done with just one?
Yeah, one of them.
And I mean, again, I think Kate is so talented that, yes, it could be done with just one, and that book is proof.
Well, but you know what? But what she has is shame.
Ah, there it is. Shame and fury.
Yeah.
Together at last. Listen, shame and fury together make a great romance novel.
Yeah, they do.
But, you know, professional driver, closed course.
Yeah.
Because it really can, that, like I said, shame is real tough to navigate.
One of the things I was also thinking about with the J.J. Arias book, which I can't remember, of course, the title of already, Fighting for Control, is there's a hint of, like shenanigans. Like, at one point, Lola has Carmen's, like, rental car towed. And she's basically like, well, it was like a car parked illegally. It didn't have the, and my threshold for like that, like pranks is really, really low. And I think like that's the other thing. It's like, how are you going to show these two adults? Like they have to, there's a point at which they cannot like go past. You have to really believe, like I really believed like the car accident part, but like at some point you're kind of like, what, you know, how far is too far? Like if it just evolves into them pranking each other, which is why, although many people love The Worst Best Man, some of it was like kind of pranky to me. And so I think like that's like the question too, is like, for me, I really just want the intensity of like, we are just so different and you do not understand like what, you know what I mean? And so like back to like Late Night Love, they like won on their first or second like show when they're the head writers, like it flops and they both know it. Mm-hmm. And like it just like raises the stakes even higher. Now what are we going to do to make it work?
So Here's my question for you about this. And it just occurred to me. So maybe it's half-baked. It is half-baked. Is it possible to do enemies to lovers justice inside a rom-com?
I mean, anything can be done, I'll say.
Right, of course. But I'm thinking like, because I would say both Ain't She Sweet. So when I think about rom-coms, I think of Susan, always. Ain't She Sweet and Kiss an Angel obviously both have funny moments, but they are not rom-coms. So, I mean, I'm thinking about it because I think I could come up with like a really solid list of books where like the characters are oil and water, but the book is a rom-com. I'm thinking about something like Dating Dr. Dill. You made me think of this when you said pranks, right?
Or like The Worst Best Man.
But there's physical comedy in that book, right? So Worst Best Man, Dating Dr. Dill, those are characters who don't like each other and are at each other's throats, but are not enemies.
Yeah. And see, that's what I would argue. Because I was kind of like, would I put The Worst Best Man on here? And I was like, no. Right? Like, it's a rom-com, and therefore, like, the stakes are somewhere different, maybe.
I think words have meaning, and I think enemies has a very particular meaning, which is why I isolated rivals out of this, and why I think rom-com maybe doesn't do it right, because... Or not right, but maybe rom-com just can't function as a proper vehicle for enemies to lovers. Because it's just, that's not what it's delivering. That's not the promise of the premise for the reader.
Right. No, I agree.
And if you want two people who are going to be like funny and cute and like quirky and charming, that's probably not the realm of enemies.
And honestly, the books that have been called rom-coms and enemies to lovers largely don't work for me. And I think without naming names, right, I'm not like necessarily interested in that. I think one of the reasons why is because of that like fundamental like sort of form versus function problem, right? And so then you're really kind of evaluating like, well, wait, this is too far, too hard, or what, like, wait, this guy is way too fucking much. Right. And it's very hard to kind of match that. Right. So, yeah, I think I think that that
if the scene has is written for humor,
yeah,
it's not enemies.
Right. 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 And there's a point at which, like,
it's something else. I don't know what it is. We need another word for it. All right, my friends, read more historicals and paranormals if you want. Enemies to lovers, I guess, is the answer here.
Have a great week, everybody. We'll see you at Faded Mates Live in a few weeks. Thanks to our sponsors. You can find us on Instagram at Faded Mates Pod, at Twitter, on Twitter at Faded Mates, on Blue Sky at Faded Mates somewhere. And I'm confused. And
Threads, we're everywhere.
Yeah. And Patreon, please join us. We have a Discord that moves 800 million miles an hour and it's super fun and we'd love to see you there.
And don't forget that if your podcast app supports it, you can click on the chapter title anytime we're talking about a book and buy the book right now. Oh, and if you can think of that book that I just described to Jen about the where the hero is just waiting for the heroine to break and she never does and then he breaks instead, please let me know. I would like to reread it.
Me too.
I like it when men break.
The real enemies to lovers right there. Bam.
Exactly. Also, as a reminder, everyone, if you just stick around right after this episode, we've got an audio sample of the My Dark Desire audiobook from Parker S. Huntington and LJ Shen coming up right now.
Well, she licked her lips, scanning my face, seeming unsure herself. Do you need something else? Your attention, your impossible words, your sweet pussy. Especially your sweet pussy. For you to stop murdering my roses, I blurted out instead, prying the shears from her fingers. You have no idea what you're doing. She laughed a little. I finished cleaning the entire place and got bored. Humor me. I said nothing. I was, in fact, humoring her, letting her get away with things I never would anyone else. Zach? Pharaoh frowned. Do you want me to touch you? Yes. No. Jesus, I have no fucking clue. I felt like I was regressing, Benjamin buttoning myself back to high school, where I didn't know how to think, feel, or act around girls. I tossed the shears into a bucket of fresh roses she'd slaughtered. You can touch me, I suppose. Though the kind of touching I had in mind wasn't something I necessarily wanted my immediate family to witness. Her lips twitched, not quite a smile. Try again. My nostrils flared. Please, touch me. She raised a brow, clearly amused. Where? Anywhere? Everywhere? But I had to keep it SFW. Seeing as Celeste Ah Yi was probably ready to break out the camcorder and offer industry tips. Face, I hissed out, humiliated and elated all at once. My whole body trembled with the admission. I want to feel skin on my face. It would be the first time since the accident, since his blood dripped into my eyes, running down my cheeks like tears. We stared at each other, and for a moment, the world ceased to exist. Birds did not chirp. Clouds did not sail overhead. My mother did not watch us with her disapproving glare. Pharaoh's chest moved with a ragged breath. She set the bucket of flowers down on the ground, her hands rising up to my face. Tell me something to distract you, she instructed, her smile soft, her voice silk. Something about the octopus. I shut my eyes. It has three hearts. I bet it loves big. Her hands almost reached my face. I could feel them hovering in front of it. I stopped breathing altogether, bracing myself for it. It is a tragic creature, I countered, popping one eye open. It can never love. It is programmed to consummate its reproductive purpose, procreate, then perish right after. It never stands a chance to live. Couldn't you call me a kitten then? Pharaoh scrunched her nose, looking annoyingly adorable. I'd even take a bunny. Kittens are a generic choice. Bunnies belong in Hugh Hefner's mansion. I opened the other eye now, shaking my head, resolute. You are an octopus. Smart. Sophisticated. Tragic. And then it happened. Her palms clasped my face from both sides, bracketing my cheeks. I sucked in a breath and slammed my eyes shut. Her warm, damp skin pressed onto mine. I forced myself to open my eyes, to look at her. Her nails grazed my skin. A shudder thundered down my spine. Look at me, Zach. She smiled. She smiled. You can do this. You can touch. Feel. We stood in the garden like two trees, sturdy but fragile, swaying gently with the wind, and I couldn't bear it. How everything slammed into me all at once. The memories, the disgust, and the guilt for wanting to feel her skin still, even though my father was dead and I couldn't even remember his dying words. What happened to you? She croaked. I shook my head. I couldn't tell. Couldn't repeat it for my own ears to hear, let alone hers. Does this feel okay? I thought about it. It feels good, bad, complicated. And that's more than I can ever ask for. Zachary! Mom barked from the balcony, dousing the moment with ice. You are late, and we are hungry. Farrell unclasped her hands from my face, darting a step back, her neck flushed. I'll see you at 4. She turned away from me, picking up the bucket of roses and scurrying toward the front door. Don't leave, I croaked, the voice coming out of nowhere. She paused, but didn't turn to face me. Don't go, she whispered, and I didn't know why, but everything felt tragic all of a sudden, like the octopus creating life just to end her own. Swiveling on my heel, feeling the sting of her hands on my face and knowing I wouldn't try to scrub it clean of her touch, I made my way to the balcony. Mom and Ai Yi sat on the marble banisters, staring at me like I'd just landed in a cornfield on a spaceship with a SpongeBob propeller hat on my head. Perplexed did not begin to cover it. They looked like they were having an out-of-body experience. You should be careful with the staff, Mom spoke loud enough for Pharaoh to hear. You don't want a sexual harassment lawsuit. I didn't answer. Growing up, people always told me, so good you survived. But had I really survived that crash? I didn't think I did. I'd lost too many parts of me that day. Still, I lived without living. After all, survivors are pros at going through the motions with the weight of everyone left behind on their shoulders, and for 21 years, that was my fate. Until now. I was making progress, slowly coming alive. Lights were too bright, food oversaturated with taste. But I was no longer dead inside. And that frightened me.